Today, John and I continue our discussion of Ossian Ward's book on contemporary art called Ways of Looking. In the third chapter, Ward says that many works of modern art are meant to be a form of confrontation. For example, artists have made fountains laced with LSD, tiny bombs set to explode in 100 years, displays of disfigured mannequins, and effigies of prominent politicians having sex with each other. One artist even used the diluted blood from murder victims to continuously mop the floors of her exhibition. Do these kinds of confrontation make for good art? And what should we think if confrontational art ever seems to cross the line into desecration or exploitation? I'm Alex Racy, and here with me to talk about those questions is John Farrell. Hey, John.
Sir.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to be back discussing art as confrontation.
We're moving toward the end of the summer, which always produces a certain desperation.
So you think this is fitting?
Yes.
The end of summer confronts us.
It does.
And
adds a certain urgency and poignancy to our pursuits.
So should we talk about our subject of confrontational art for today?
Why not?
First, a quick introduction about confrontational art in general. So I gave some examples of confrontational art at the start of the podcast, but our author Ward says that confrontational art doesn't have to be as outrageous as those examples. According to him, it can consist of objects that are, for example, simply in your way or disturbing the peace. And your relationship with these objects creates a kind of what he calls electric charge because they are somehow in your way or standing out or demanding your attention. He also says that even art that's just purposefully ugly can be confrontational, again, because it's demanding your attention. Now, he also mentions or talks about what's supposed to be good about confrontational art. And he points out that one thing that's useful from the artist's point of view is that confrontational art grabs your attention. And that is, of course, something artists are trying to do. But he adds, I think very helpfully, that that's not enough to make confrontational art worth doing. It's got to get at something, well, what he calls some part of the human condition or some overlooked, what he calls internal dread that we couldn't get at through some other means. He also mentions that he's wary of it doing this in a direct way or too direct of a way. He thinks that if artists confront us but also preach a message, that's not going to be good confrontational art. There should be some sort of ambiguity or room left to interpret what's confrontational about the art or what its message is.
Let me just say one thing about that list of qualities that he seeks in confrontational art.
Sure.
It's a well-known list of cliches about art. That on the one hand, it's supposed to shock you out of your normal way of thinking. On the other hand, it's not supposed to tell you anything. It's supposed to leave a message to your own judgment. And really, theorists of art go back and forth between the horns of that dilemma endlessly. So there's nothing especially surprising about his formulation. And it needn't apply primarily to confrontational art. It's those things are said about every kind of representational art over and over again.
Oh, that all art is supposed to be, in some sense, a confrontation with your intellect.
Yes.
But, of course, he has in mind, when he talks about confrontational art, something, I mean, could we just define it as something more extreme or shocking?
Yes. And nowadays, when most works of art don't have any obvious point, right, as we've been talking about in this series of podcasts, when so many of the artworks leave you saying, what the heck is that and why is it art? The confrontational ones do go back to a more familiar function of art, which is to say something. But since theorists of art and many artists are so wary about actually saying anything definite, then they feel they have to qualify that with, but no, you don't want to preach to us. You want to tell us something, give us an experience that makes us think. You want to lead us to that thing indirectly and leave space for our own consciousness and freedom and so on.
I see. So in your view, this confrontational art that he's talking about, in a way, it's very familiar and kind of old-fashioned.
Much more old-fashioned than the other things that we've been talking about. And of course, it is almost all totally preachy.
Right. Even though it's not supposed to have a definite message, when you've got a couple of politicians who are shown, you know, engaging in lewd acts,
yes,
you're not unclear on the message of the author.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And I don't think these kinds of artworks tend to leave us a lot of room for interpretation. But anyway, I just wanted to remark on the very familiar element of his way of going about defining confrontational.
Well, and maybe we'll test some of these observations as we look at specific artworks.
Okay.
So should we try the first one, which is
yes,
called Touching Reality?
Touching Reality.
I thought maybe I'd just read our author's description of it because it's very good. So the author of our book, Ward, talks about being in a museum and then having his attention drawn toward essentially a TV monitor. And he says, this is a quote, "The TV monitor shows another screen, that of an iPad or a touch tablet, with a woman's hand scrolling through what can only be described as sickeningly raw photographic images of suicide bombings, charred human remains, bloody decapitations, mutilated faces, and detached, misshaped torsos. As the hand on screen casually swipes or nimbly pinches at the hideous images to zoom in on some fresh horror, pausing only to focus our attention on a victim or to dwell on bystanders who might be wielding a camera phone or a digital camcorder to capture the terrifying scenes for themselves." So that's his description. Does that seem, you probably had a look at this as I did. One can look at YouTube and see various clips of Touching Reality by Hirshhorn. Does that seem to be a good description?
Yes. The site that I looked at, you actually do your own flipping. You do your own swiping, so to speak, and go from one image to another. So I wasn't able to get one that showed the actual presentation of the iPad swiping inside the.
I see.
So that would not come up for me on YouTube.
I see. Yeah, I found an actual clip of what he's describing, which is, you know, you're looking at a screen on your screen and the hand moving and swiping and so on.
So essentially, you're watching somebody watching.
Yeah, and maybe we'll come back to this, but I think importantly, you're not just watching them watch it, you're watching them navigate it in the tactile way that we now navigate on screens with our fingers, touching the images and so on. Well, so what do we make of this as a work of art? Should I start or should you?
Why don't you start this time?
Okay. I mean, I think the first thing to note is that it's kind of a revolting work of art. I mean, on the visceral level, it's very hard to look at, partly because the images are so incredibly gruesome. I mean, these are the sorts of images that would be filtered out of any news presentation. They're just overly shocking. So it's very hard to watch. I do think the confrontational nature of it, if you want to call it that, does have a particular effect, which is that you're watching something so gruesome that you have a certain kind of reaction that I think the artist wants you to have, which is that you're disturbed, first of all, by the images. You're disturbed by the sort of casual way in which this mysterious hand is moving through them and zooming in and so on, partly because you can't see any shock in the hand, right? The hand is just navigating in this kind of casual way.
It's like the techno version of flipping through a magazine.
That's right. And I think another thing that's shocking about it because of its particular confrontational nature is that it does make you think about the somewhat bizarre tactile way in which we interact with images, right? So it's fine to swipe on your phone and on a tablet if you're not swiping or touching something gruesome, but there is something odd about imagining oneself using your hand to move through images in this way. So, I mean, those are sort of gut visceral reactions, but also, you know, I think there's a kind of inevitable reaction that one's going to have to this, which is that you are going to naturally think about a couple of different subjects. One is about the gruesome nature of the world we live in and the terrible things that happen in it. And you're naturally going to think about your own detached perspective on it, at least if you're a person like me and you who lives in the way that we do. You know, we're sequestered off from these things. We never have to confront their reality, both the reality that they happen to other people, and we certainly never face the prospect that they'll happen to us. And then also, I think inevitably you ask questions about the way in which we interact with the images, looking at them almost sometimes in a kind of curious way or detached way. So I guess overall, I think it's a terribly gruesome thing that does effectively make you ask certain, in some ways, obvious questions about the gruesome things that you're seeing. So to that extent, I thought it was effective. I mean, I think the author or the artist in this case pretty clearly had a purpose in doing things this way, and it seems to succeed in getting you to ask those questions. And maybe we'll have to ask in a minute whether those questions are worth asking in that way. But I don't know. That was my initial reaction. What did you think?
And I think that's the way it's meant to be understood. I think that's a fair statement of it. You know, perhaps being a literature professor, I've been exposed to this concern too many times by now, so that I'm jaded about it, which is the artist trying to get you to realize what's really happening out there, right? And Hirshhorn believes that our media softens the images that come towards us and accommodates to our effete sensibilities, he says, and that we should be attacked, we should be assaulted, in a sense, by these horrific images. So on the one hand, he seems to be objecting to the filter that the media place on things. I have my doubts about that, because on the whole, it seems to me that the media is constantly bombarding us with everything unpleasant and difficult and troubling and threatening that's happening in the whole world. And if anything, it's making the world seem more threatening and making it more difficult to imagine a normal life out there than it should be. So I'm very skeptical of that point of view, that the media is dulcifying things.
I think I disagree with you. I mean, okay. I think in some ways the media does make the world look more dangerous than it actually is, right? So they report on crime and all the terrible things. And if your picture of the world around you was formed only through news reports, you would think that walking on any given city street was horribly dangerous. So I don't have any doubt that they give you an impression of your own society that makes it look more dangerous. But on the other hand, the media tends to radically underreport on world news, which is a lot of what this is about, right? It's about things that happen in faraway places where people are murdered or slaughtered. I mean, the Yes. media doesn't really report in any substantial way on global poverty or global warfare, you know, except for a few particular causes which catch it its attention that week. So I actually think that I wouldn't criticize the Hirshhorn for this. I mean, I think he actually is pointing out a real hole in media coverage, which is that the world for many, many people is a very, very horrible place in a way that's not depicted in the media.
Well, that is certainly true. It's especially true of American media. It's much less true of media elsewhere. And that's not because, you know, they're not presenting enough graphic stuff. Americans just aren't interested in things that are going on in the rest of the world, even though we're involved in it as a government so heavily.
Well, so how about your second point, though, which was about the idea that, you know, maybe Hirshhorn's art in a certain way is kind of futile because it's not going to get anyone to do anything. I mean, I think I agree with that. Ward at one point even says something like, our reaction to this is to pretend to care or something like that, which I thought was a nice point. But I'm not sure that that makes it not worth doing, because I just think the natural state of human beings is that we're constantly reminded of how to be better than we are. And then we backslide and we don't behave in as good a way as we're supposed to. But I don't know that that means that we shouldn't remind ourselves of the need to be better. So somebody like Hirshhorn comes along and tries to remind you, at least for a short period of time, that the world is a terrible place for many people and we ought to care about this. And sure, you stop caring the second you walk away from the exhibit, but I don't know, we give ourselves little reminders in order to try to be better. And who knows, maybe they add up over time. I guess that would be my defense of this art that seems futile in some way or other.
Well, I'm not saying it has to change the world utterly. I just find it a rather stale approach because it's so familiar. You know, the images themselves are horrible. It's again making this point that we insulate ourselves. And it seems contradictory also. On the one hand, he's saying, I'm going to show you these real images that are horrible. But then he's showing a finger flipping through them as if they were pleasurable. And I don't know how you put those two things together.
Yeah, I was thinking that the artist thought that the clever thing is that it does both, right? Because at least my own personal experience is that the images do sometimes horrify me, and sometimes my attention is drawn to the flipping fingers. So I'm actually having both experiences. Sometimes I am having the horrified direct contact with the image, and at other times I'm pondering the mysterious hand's detached relationship to those images.
You know, I mean, when you look at these things, you see this in a museum, you're walking through and you look at it, right? The whole format doesn't really lend itself to saying, okay, now let's discuss this. Or discuss it with someone, even share it with other viewers or something like that. In a way, though, seeing it on the internet would probably produce more discussion than seeing it in a museum. The museum aspect of it, I really wonder if this is something that is effective as a museum piece.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that as well, and it made me think a little bit about my own relationship to museums, because I was thinking that if I saw this in a museum in the way that it was originally presented, I would have the reaction you just described, which is that my mind would naturally look at it as an aesthetic object and much less as a call to action, which is what the artist, I think, intended it to be. But I could imagine that somebody who's very into contemporary art would say, oh, look, Alex, that's because you're very old-fashioned about museums and you expect them to have beautiful objects in them. But museums are actually places of political statement and political discourse. And so maybe they would think that this was a flaw in the way that you and I view museums rather than a flaw with the artist's idea of putting it in a museum.
But I mean, the way museums are arranged doesn't give space to a discussion. right? It's still a kind of hieratic space. It's a space with religious hush around it, right? And, you know, I think that there would be problems if you and I went in there and started engaging in a conversation that could be heard with other of the museum guests.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, I think the state of museums and the conventions that surround them do actually constrain how you can react when you're in one. I mean, I was even imagined seeing this in one room, and then, you know, in the next room, they have impressionist landscapes, right? And, you know, so there you are, and one part of your brain is supposed to be engaging aesthetically, and then you walk into this next room and are supposed to have serious political thoughts. It's not a switch people can make easily. And so this is another way in which the museum space itself constrains the kind of reaction you can have to the piece.
And then in the next room, the lights are going on and off. And you're supposed to be saying, wow, what is art? Is this art? So the whole thing just shows to me the lack of a strong framework for doing anything with art.
You know, this reminds me of a different criticism I had of the piece, although it's related to the one you just made, which is that forgetting its success as a work of art or political statement, I worried about the morality of this thing, because this piece of art seems to me on the verge of disrespecting the dead and tortured and mutilated people who are in the images. And partly that's because these images are now being placed in a museum, which is a place where, as you say, we don't naturally think in political and moral terms, but in aesthetic ones. And it's almost as though these formerly living human beings are now being held up before us as art objects. And I'm not sure that I'm morally comfortable with that, regardless of its success as an aesthetic object.
I think at least in the local terms of the piece, it's clearly meant to have moral impact, right? And they are meant to stand for all the people who are suffering in the world. So I don't feel that terribly much as a drawback.
Well, but there are two ways in which I'm not sure the artist just gets to say, hey, I intended that this would be a political discussion. One is that, as you say, once you take it and stick it in a museum, you can predict that people will have certain reactions to it. And as an artist, you've got to account for those. And if you're encouraging people to have aesthetic reactions to the death of other human beings, it seems to me that's a problem with your artwork. And the other is, of course, that the artist has put in this hand, which is casually scanning past the objects. And the artist is encouraging you, at least some of the time, to not think about the horror of what you're seeing, but rather to think about your own, essentially, practices and how you view media. And you might think, well, wait, that's not what's important here. What's important are the human beings. And once again, the artist has failed to properly respect the people who appear in the photographs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the main thrust of it is a sense of, you know, we're consuming images with pleasure, right? When they are, and the things are really horrible, and it's a kind of accusation of voyeurism that the artwork is making.
Right. I think that is one of the things it's doing. And actually, that's one of the interesting things it's doing by having the hand flipping through the images. And it's a way in which it's not just a familiar repetition of this idea that we should be doing more for the world. It is actually getting you to think about the way we look at images and the tactile way in which we now do it.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the tactile part. I don't feel that there's a great sensuality in stroking the screen.
No, but I think that part of what I was led to think about, and I think maybe what a lot of people would naturally think about, is the fact that with images, we don't scroll through them with mouse clicks, at least not all the time. It's that we reach out and touch them and swipe them. And now ask yourself, how comfortable would you be doing that if the images were not filtered by the media with the worst ones taken out, but you actually had to reach out and touch the terrible images from around the world? And look, in some sense, you shouldn't be repulsed by that, because you're not touching a dead human body, you're touching a screen. But of course, that's not the way the human mind works. There is a natural horror at the idea of touching your finger to this, admittedly, image of a destroyed human body. And I think it's particularly interesting to think about why you would be so uncomfortable with that, or whether you should be more uncomfortable than you are.
That's interesting. I don't feel that natural horror at touching the screen and a horrible image. I wouldn't be more disturbed if there was a slideshow. I think it's even less vivid as an experience to touch a screen image than it would be to touch a photograph. Let me make one more point about the touching reality.
Yeah.
The title is oddly ambiguous. Is it reality that's touching, or is it touching reality, right? He's playing with that. And that seems to be, that kind of pushes to your, perhaps to your idea about how important the actual tactile experience is.
Right, that he's trying to depict a reality which is touching in the sense of moving, but also that he's trying to call your attention to the way in which we touch these images.
Yes.
So should we try artwork number two?
Yes.
This is called 160 centimeter line tattooed on four people. And the description we get from the book, and I went and looked this up, I'm sure you did as
yes.
well, but what it says is Santiago Sierra, that's the artist, paid four Spanish prostitutes to have a 40 centimeter line tattooed across the middle of their backs in exchange for a shot of heroin with a street value of about $67. And that's what the artwork is. And just to be clear, it's not that it's a photograph of this happening or a movie, although, of course, that's the way we see it since we weren't there. But the actual artwork was a kind of performance piece, right?
Right.
So Santiago Sierra had the four women there and was tattooing them. And
yeah.
So let's talk about this.
Yeah. I find it objectionable on almost every level I can think of.
Right.
And you know, it seems to point to the ridiculous license that we are willing to give to artists to do anything that they can think of and call it art. And you know, what's the basis of his moral stance that could make him want to manipulate these people, put a line in their backs, and so on? You know, where does he come off doing that?
Well, right, and maybe we'll have to sort out several different topics, but it sounds like your first reaction was not, is it good art or is it art at all, but just something about how objectionable this is as a practice and where does he as an artist get off doing this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it really is art in any serious sense. I don't think framing it as art changed their attitude towards it. I think it's a statement of a certain kind. Look, there are people in our world who are in such a condition that you can give them a shot of heroin and they'll let you draw a line on their backs that you can't get rid of. And that does tell you something about our world.
Right.
It certainly does, but if we didn't know it, I'm not sure this is a reasonable way of communicating it to us.
Yeah. See, I'm less worried than you are about the question of whether or not it's art at all. I mean, you know, look, I don't have an answer to the very vexed question of what makes something art, but I'm willing to be very broad-minded about it and to say, okay, so this is some sort of theater piece. I mean, I could imagine the artist saying, for example, we pay actors to do certain things on stage,
sure.
Often to do things that they wouldn't normally do, like take off their clothes or make certain sorts of statements in public that they wouldn't do. And I can imagine him saying this is a certain sort of theater or performance art. So I don't object to this on the grounds that I don't want to count it as art. But obviously this artist had in mind the idea that this would call to our attention the things you mentioned earlier, which is that the world is full of very, very desperate people who will do things with their bodies in exchange for a shot of heroin. So for me, I think if it has value, it's not because it is a work of art, but because it somehow succeeds in doing what the artist is after in some sort of interesting artistic way, which I don't think it does. So I would count it as a failure on those grounds. And also, I mean, and we really should get to this, the fact that it's completely morally objectionable.
On every level. You're an ethicist. I'll let you lay out the many different ways in which it's objectionable before I second it.
Well, I don't, this is one of these cases where I don't think you need deep theory. Although, you know, philosophers have written a lot of theory about exploitation and treatment of other human beings.
Yes.
But you don't have to go very far, right? So a very simple definition, I guess you could say, of exploitation would be that you take unfair advantage of other people. And that's what this artist has done, right? He's found people who occupy a position where they are unfairly put in a completely desperate situation and are willing to have their bodies tattooed in exchange for heroin. And he's decided to take advantage of that by giving them the heroin in order to produce a piece of art to make a political statement. And I mean, it's just exploitation in the most straightforward way. Now, look, to do a little bit of theory, when people do argue that exploitation can be justified, it's usually when there are these situations where allegedly there's no alternative. So the classic case from ethics that gets discussed all the time is sweatshop labor. And the hypothetical you're given is, what if you're the head of a company and the only choices you have are to not do business in the developing world or to employ people at ridiculously terrible labor standards, and it's important you have no other alternative, right? The hypothetical is always, if you pay them any bit more than you're paying them, your company will go out of business. And sure, you can have a debate in those cases about whether it's better to do business under those conditions. And the argument in favor of it is, well, look, if the people are taking the jobs, they're probably better than the other awful jobs that those people could have. But it's important to recognize, first of all, that even in the business context, that's a hypothetical. It's not true. There are other ways of doing business in the developing world. But regardless of what we think about business, it's certainly not true of this artist, right? So this artist, these were not the only alternatives he had for creating art or for interacting with these women. I mean, for goodness sakes, he could have just given them money. He surely has enough money that if he felt bad for the poor of the world, he could have just made a donation, right? So he has absolutely no excuse for exploiting people in this way, I think. So there's my rant. Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, and also he's encouraging their heroin addiction.
Yeah.
Right? I'm assuming they're already addicted to heroin.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's not hope, but let's hope that if he gave them heroin, he didn't create new heroin addicts.
Right, right. I mean, and he's contributing to the whole drug problem in a broader way. And, you know, to me, you don't even need as much theory as you announced there to see that the whole thing is barbative.
Right. And this is only one dimension, you know, the exploitation. But there's another thing he's doing, which is kind of similar to something we talked about with touching reality, which is that he's taking human beings and he's encouraging, at least somewhat, an aesthetic attitude toward them rather than a moral attitude of respect toward your fellow human beings. And that also I find deeply objectionable. Now, look, we should play a little devil's advocate. I'm sure what the artist would say is something like, yes, I've done something bad. I think there's even a quote in our book to the effect that the author admits that he's done something bad.
Yeah.
But he would say it's in the service of a greater good, which is that he's calling the world's attention to the exploitation that occurs around the world. So I think that would be his defense of what he's done. He wouldn't deny that he's done something bad. He would just say it's somehow justified by the greater good that he's producing. But then, of course, he's held hostage to reality. Has he actually done enough good for the world to justify the terrible thing that he's done to these four people? And I think it's hard to believe that he has, given that his artwork has not changed the world or as far as we know, done anything to correct these problems.
And I also think that in addition to the problem of treating these four people that way, it's a model of how you're treating people. It's not just about them. It's just about it's an attitude toward them that seems to reproduce rather than call attention to the problem.
Right.
Right. It seems an example of exploitation rather than a message about it.
Yeah. Now, I will say, just to generalize to the general subject of art as confrontation, that one thing I did think about, which I found interesting about both of these artworks, is that each of them in their own way uses human beings as the object of your attention. Not just a drawing of a human being, but they're really trying to get you to think about the reality of the human being that is in the art object. And I can understand now why an artist would want to do that, because it does provoke your attention and provoke human reactions in a way that conventional artistic representations don't. And so I was led to understand why art as confrontation might be a particularly interesting or powerful form of artwork. I just happen to think that in this case, with the 160 centimeter line and to some extent touching reality, these techniques of using real human beings have not been done in the morally acceptable way. But I understand the temptation for artists to do it.